Welcome back, podcast fans. I'm your host, Annette Hines, and this is Parenting Impossible, the Special Needs Survival Podcast. Well, the Americans with Disability Act will be 33 today, and we've made a lot of progress, but it's not enough. And I guess I want to talk to you today before I introduce our guest about what you can do. You know, what can you do to make a difference? Maybe you already have a disabled person in your life who you are caring for, so you're making a difference every day. My guest and I talked about the whole starfish effect, where, you know, you are making the difference in one starfish's life. So you can't save all the starfish, that's true. But you've thrown one starfish back in the sea, so you've made a difference in their life. And that's amazing. That's great. But when it comes to making a difference for the disabled in our community, one thing you can do is be aware of what is ableism and fighting ableism. So familiarizing yourself with that term, even if you live in the disability world and the disability community, even if you are disabled, you know, start there. What is ableism? It is a form of discrimination, one that is often forgotten. It's the false idea that disabled people are by default, because of their disability, by default, that's what that means, inferior. When in reality, in truth, their disability, the disability, is just another way for their body or their mind to be. So that's what ableism is. And disability is it's not a defect. It's human diversity. Ableism affects those with disabilities because it inhibits access to healthcare, access to government and education, access to housing, access to religion, access to media, access to the legal system, access to employment, access to fun and all kinds of entertainment and enjoyment, recreation, anything, pretty much anything in life that you can think of. That's ableism. So just stop ableism. Remove the ask. Stop us having to ask about it. So spread the word. Use the hashtag ADA33 symbol and move it forward. There's been a something going around on LinkedIn that I've been participating in and been commenting on. And it's been about the Florida Supreme Court. They had a court case about where Florida has been keeping disabled kids institutionalized rather than allowing them to come home with care. It's something that we talk about a lot on this podcast. It's called institutional bias, where Medicaid will pay for care in institutions, but they won't use the same dollars to pay for care at home or in the community. And that means that families or individuals with disabilities are forced to choose care in an institution or they get no care at all. And so now Florida I mean, I'm oversimplifying, but Florida has given kids the right to be cared for at home instead of in institutions. But this is so oversimplifying because while it's a great first step, you know, I live in a state in Massachusetts where we've already done that. But in effect, when you return kids or individuals, adults home, and you give them, you know, quote, the right to get care at home, but you don't, you know, you do that legally, but you don't fund it. You don't then, you know, back that with money. What happens is you, in essence, push that burden onto families, and you basically still haven't given the true choice of getting care at home, because the funding in institutional care is absolute, but the funding at home is not. There's long waiting lists. There is very little support. There are no people to do the care. And, you know, we have, you know, quote, closed all the institutions because we think it's cruel, and totally agree with that. But now there's no institutional choices either, especially not for kids, but for adults as well in many cases. And so now we've pushed all the responsibility back on families. We have no community places for people to go. And the community places that we do have are, you know, very difficult to get. And so those community options are not great, or they are poorly matched or poorly monitored in a lot of cases, poorly funded for sure. So we have to come with a full commitment when we have these court cases and regulations, because otherwise we're not fully funding a meaningful life. And our people will continue to be seen as too expensive, less worthy, which is what that really comes down to, and not part of our community. And I know this is really blunt, but you know, I spend my days fighting for essential services and supports for our most vulnerable people. And those services and supports should be given freely, but they're not. So without further ado, I would like to introduce to you this podcast episode where I am so happy to introduce you to one of my favorite people that I fight with. My guest today is Peter Morin, and I will share with you on this episode how we met and how he came to join me on this fight. I hope you love him as much as I do. And here we go. Here today with one of my favorite people, Peter Morin. He's an attorney. He works with Special Needs Law Group. We're so lucky to have him. He popped into my world kind of by accident, but man, are we so lucky that we have him. He got introduced to me by a really good friend. He lives in a really lovely part of our state in Massachusetts, down on the South Shore. And he's a retired attorney. He's really a municipal attorney. And that means that he has spent quite a lot of time working for state and local governments. And I would find that very frustrating, but we're going to talk to Peter about his lovely long career and why he decided to circle back and do some of this work after he supposedly retired and was completely free of all of this. Welcome, Peter. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Annette. It's always great to talk to you.
So, Peter, let's just walk through just for a couple of minutes what your career has been like. You've worked for two state agencies, the Department of Developmental Services, which works with people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. It was not called that back in the day. It was the Department of Mental Retardation. We don't use those terms anymore. Mm-hmm. And also the Department of Mental Health. And then you went on to work for one of our towns. And you must have some stories. Oh my gosh. So what has that been like? What was your role in both the state organizations that you worked for?
Well, I was an agency attorney and for large government agencies. Department of Mental Health had hundreds of millions of dollars in budget and probably 15 staff attorneys. And I was originally just a field attorney, and then I became the regional counsel for the southeastern region of Massachusetts for the Department of Mental Health. And so I would do all the legal work for three residential facilities on the South Shore in Fall River and Brockton and all the way down on Cape Cod. I did the civil commitment work, and I did guardianships for folks that were living in the communities that needed them as well. And so I went from there into the State House to work for the department or for the Committee on Criminal Justice for a couple of years. And then I came back out, worked at Department of Correction in Bridgewater State Hospital doing civil commitments and guardianships for the people that needed treatment and strict security facilities. And then went back to DMH to be Director of Investigations, and then subsequently ended up at Department of Developmental Services that had $1 billion budget and 15 attorneys at one time. And we were cut down to 8. And I was supervising all the attorneys that did guardianship work throughout the Commonwealth for DDS, as well as overseeing all the contract work between the vendors that provided residential services for folks with disabilities and a department. That was about $700 million worth of contracting. So it was very busy, very rewarding in a way, because you were trying to do really large scale projects to provide better services to people, which is very challenging. At night, at the same time, I was an elected official in the town of Braintree, where I live. I was a member of the select board and later an assessor. And then I was the chair of the Charter Commission to change the form of government, which succeeded in changed Braintree into a mayor council form of government. And then that's when I changed my career path onto municipal government and became chief of staff and operations for the mayor of Braintree, did that for 7 years. And then I was hired by the town of Norwell for 8 years to be their town administrator, which is basically overseeing the daily operations of a municipality of about 10,000 people, much smaller staff and budget than those agencies. And then I retired. When I retired, I wanted to find something that would make me still useful. And pretty much I stumbled onto into you. I contacted another attorney that referred me to you. And I've really enjoyed working with Special Needs Law Group and seeing the great work that is done there and trying to help out wherever I can with my background in dealing with agencies and how they think and what they need. For, you know, to provide an individual with services and just try to close the gaps for people that are frustrated when their family member is transitioning into services with a large agency.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, everybody. Have you been searching for a law firm that understands the unique challenges of your family? We can help. My name is Annette Hines, and I'm a mom and an attorney. And I'm also an advocate. And I started Special Needs Law Group because when my family was young, I struggled to find all the services and support that my family needed. We can help here at Special Needs Law Group with special needs trusts, guardianships, and maybe you aren't even sure what you need yet, and we can help with that too. Book a free call today. You can either use our link in the show notes, or you can go to www.specialneeds-law.com. See you soon. So first and foremost, thank you so much for being there. Peter reminds me of the story that I love about the little boy walking on the shore trying to save the starfish, you know, and somebody asks him the question about, well, why do you bother throwing that one starfish back in the sea? There are millions of them here. It's not going to matter. It's not going to make a difference. And he says, yeah, but it makes a difference to that one starfish. And, you know, that's what we're doing in our law group. And that's what Peter's doing. He's making a difference to one family. Yeah, I get it. It's only one family, or maybe it's two families, but to those two families, it's everything. So we do have to keep trying, because what are you going to do? Stop doing anything? You can't. Yes. You have to keep trying. Even if the rising tide is like blowing you away, you still have to keep trying. So I have to toot Peter's horn a little bit. A good chunk of the work that he does for us is free. It's pro bono work. And he's amazing. Now, don't open the floodgates and everybody start calling us and saying that you want free pro bono work. We are so tiny and we have to be very selective on the pro bono court cases that we take. And we're full up right now. Not to be mean or anything, but Peter's done some amazing work. And I think we're probably going to talk a little bit about, you know, one or two of the pro bono cases that we've worked on together the last couple months, but Peter coming to us and wanting to help and wanting to, you know, really make a difference in that starfish way has allowed us the manpower that we needed. And with his expertise, it has allowed us to make a difference in a couple more families' lives. And we are so grateful. Thank you, Peter. It's been great.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity. You know, it's not every office that would take on someone, at my stage of the career and just, you know, let me help out. It takes a special kind of, person and group to accommodate someone like me. And I'm really happy to have the opportunity to work with you and that and everyone else, do amazing work every day.
Our team is so awesome.
It's incredibly skilled. It's an incredibly skilled group.
He's way too modest though. He's such a great addition. So, all right, enough of this love fest. I want to get okay. to the audience. What the audience wants to know is really, you know, working with these state agencies and local organizations, municipalities, it's like banging your head against a wall sometimes. And
sure.
The reason that I wanted Peter to come on the show and talk about some of our experiences and some of the things that frankly we do really well is because not everybody can afford an attorney or an advocate like us. And in a lot of places, you can't even find them. There isn't people out there like us. There aren't advocates. There aren't attorneys who do this work. And we want you to gain the skills that you need to do this for yourself, for your family. So I want to walk through some of the basics that you need to be able to maneuver through these state agencies and these organizations that are frankly just holding the key to the services, supports, the money that you need for survival. So let's just kind of step through that a little bit. Peter, what's the number one thing that you found on the inside and now being on the outside, the number one critical skill as an advocate, what do you need to know?
The first thing that you have to remember from the outside looking in is an agency is big and it can be daunting, but I think it's best if you don't treat them like an adversary, but someone that you need to work with, and that the people that are working in that agency, it can be frustrating because you're going to think, well, they're going to give me regulations that I don't understand, and they don't want to help me. From being in a number of agencies, 99.9% of the people that work in the agencies didn't take the job so that they could say no to people. They want to help. The problem is it's a large scale organization dealing on a broad spectrum of cases with finite resources, even though they have big budgets, that have time constraints. The employees have time constraints. So they may rush you through things. The biggest thing I think that you can do is, if you're trying to get into services, is plan ahead. Know when you're going to, a family member is transitioning and in need of services, start early on making contacts with that agency. Find out who you're dealing with, and then find out what they need and ask questions. There is no stupid question that you can ask. If you don't understand something, if you're feeling rushed, let the person know in the agency that you're dealing with, can you slow this down and please explain it to me? And find out exactly what they're looking for. Don't be rushed into putting your paperwork together and putting your application together and getting your information. Take your time, get it right, get as much information or more information than they're asking for that you possibly can in the form that they want it. And that's going to help you a great deal.
All right, I'm going to boil that down into a couple of key bullet points. Number one, plan ahead. You're singing my song. I love a planner, okay? So plan ahead as much as you can. Number two, ask questions. And that's really along the lines of good communication. Number three, fill out forms and provide as much paperwork in the form that they've asked for. So those are the things that I heard you say. It sounds like those are three key points. So number one, plan ahead, give yourself a lot of time. Number two, ask questions and communicate clearly. And number three, fill out forms, the forms that they've provided in the way that they've provided, and provide all of the documentation and paperwork. So that's what I heard Peter say. So those are your three key points that he's saying will help you, and that everybody is there to help you. They are just, such a big organization. They came into these jobs wanting to do the right thing, wanting to provide services. There's a lot standing in their way. But you can do your part to help them do their part. Okay. What if you're in crisis and for reasons that are not your fault, maybe it is your fault, you don't have the benefit of a long time to plan? What now?
I think you explain the situation to the agency that you're dealing with. And sometimes when you're in crisis, you can be put to the head of the line because of an emergent situation. And they will address, they will help you address that emergency sometimes. The best thing you can do is inform the agency that you're dealing with of what the difficulties you're facing are and see if there can be a waiver, an exemption, an extension of time, or that they can suggest a way for you to alleviate that crisis or address it. It may be the first time it's happened to you, but it's probably not the first time that the agency's seen someone in your circumstances. And they may be willing, you know, to assist you on that. Basically, the best thing you can do is just stay the course, hang in there, ask questions, and communicate your situation to the agency. If you're having difficulty providing information to them, let them know why. And, you know, if you're filling out an application and you can get someone to look at your answers and say, is this the type of thing you're looking for? That can save you a lot of time and trouble so that you know that you're on the right track or how you might want to fix your application before you submit it and get it sent back to you saying it's wrong.
Oh yeah, sometimes you're thinking you're giving them everything and you're just missing each other in the night. We recently had someone that we've been working with, and you know, the family's been giving all this information, they're getting denials, and it turns out that the record's incomplete, but nobody can figure out why. And the family's just not asking the right questions and the agency's not giving them the correct information. Peter, why don't you just walk us through that case a little bit? And that would be some really good illustration of, you know, how good communication doesn't always happen.
Sure, I'll be happy to. It's hard enough when you're dealing with one agency, but then if you're dealing with an individual that may be receiving services from two agencies, that can be even more difficult. And so Annette and I have been working with a couple of clients that have family members in that situation. And so you have to find out what both agencies are looking for in order to provide services. And sometimes one agency won't provide services unless the other agency agrees to provide services too. And so you've got to work, it's like working through a maze and finding out, you know, what needs to be done. Now, on top of that, this family was dealing with a child that was aging out of a school system and going to be transitioning into the two other agencies from their school system for services. And that the family felt rushed because they felt the loss of services from the school was imminent. So they put together an application in good faith that they thought would be enough for eligibility. They talked to their medical providers and got documentation and submitted it. And they thought that they had, quote unquote, checked all the boxes. But because things were rushed, the experts that they contacted didn't write out or fill out their parts of the application in the way that was sufficient for one of the agencies. So what I did was contacted the lawyer for the agency, found out, you know, what was missing, what they were looking for, contacted the medical expert, told him, look, you wrote a nice letter before, but we just need you to do a little bit more. Can I give you a draft of a letter and you look it over? And if it makes sense, can you sign that? And then we can submit it to the agency and I think it'll work. The doctor did. We resubmitted. We got that person eligible. Because we got that person eligible for the one agency, the second agency said, okay, now we can provide more services because this individual has, you know, two problems that they're dealing with. And so we were able to clear up some of the lacking or the shortcomings in the initial application and get this person back in good standing, so that they're in a position where they are now eligible for services that they're going to need as an adult. So it's basically, you know, it's like working your way through a maze and finding out exactly what has to be documented in order to get those services. And we were able to do that. And, you know, it's a good feeling at the end of it.
It is. But when you think about it, oh, you have to feel so frustrated for the families, though, because, you know, child X or adult X has diagnoses that doctors have confirmed, multiple diagnoses.
Right.
That should qualify them for services.
Absolutely.
In the regulations. And they're getting denied for services, even though they have certain diagnoses. And how would you know as a layperson that all this documentation you've provided by qualified clinical people, doctors and clinicians and this and that, is not good enough?
You wouldn't.
And then, you know, why would you know, and how would you know to go back and forth with your doctors? Oh, I need more. I need you to say X things, you know? And most people would just walk away and they would be losing a lifetime of services.
Right.
And money, you know, really the money that goes with those services.
Right.
And in this case, it had such a you know, a rolling effect, because this domino effect of losing services from another agency, which required two disabilities in order to be able to, you know, provide that second level of services.
Yep.
Right. You know, so you couldn't prove the first disability because you were denied from that first agency. Oh my gosh, it was just such a mess. And, you know, here's a lawyer telling us, not a clinician, not a doctor, saying you don't have this disability. No, the lawyer is saying, well, you haven't proven you have this disability, even though the doctor is saying he has the disability. He has the diagnosis, you know.
Right.
Where do we come to in society where a lawyer gets to say, no, I'm sorry, you don't have this diagnosis. You haven't proven it.
Oh, the real problem with this case, this was a perfect storm type of case where the individual as a child had been diagnosed, and in the intervening time, diagnosis had become more refined by the diagnostic statistical manual that everyone uses. Mm-hmm. And so the diagnosis that worked 15 years ago wouldn't work now under the regulations. Nobody, you know, this individual still had, and if you looked at the updated regulate or manual, still met the criteria, but it was under a different label years ago. And so as a child, the individual was receiving services. So they didn't really update the record anticipating that things would change as an adult. So that was working against him. The other thing was the family did the right thing and went to an expert and asked them to write a letter. But that expert is seeing probably 100 other patients, has a lot to do, and wrote a very quick letter. And if you're, you know, writing a letter to excuse somebody for 5 days from being absent from work for 5 days,
right,
two sentences will do. But if you're looking for eligibility from a state agency, their regulations are going to be very, very tight on what they need. So they are, especially lawyers, are very, very sensitive to creating precedents that could open up problems for the agency and making people eligible that aren't supposed to be eligible. So you have to, you have to get it right the first time. And for a family member to tell a doctor to fill it out, you know, that I need it really carefully written, they're not going to be able to do that.
No, because they're not going to understand what words they need. What is?
They're also not going to have the leverage in the conversation. They're not going to, you know, they're asking for something. They're basically, you know, I really need your help, whatever you can do. And it's more that the doctor has to realize what they need to do.
And let's also be kind to the doctors. They don't get paid to write these 100,000 letters that people ask them for. And they do it after hours. Out of the goodness of their hearts.
No.
And, you know, let's praise the doctors that do these things for us too.
He's an excellent doctor. He's an excellent doctor. He didn't think he was doing anything wrong. He did what would work in 9 out of 10 cases. But when you're being asked for an eligibility, you got to be more elaborate, and you got to give, you know, so, I was able to help him out in that way. I knew what the agency was looking for, and I put a draft together that he could work off of. So,
but a lot of families would not have been able to recover from this, and most families would not have been able to afford an advocate to be able to, you know, go through all of this. Now, in Massachusetts, we have a very fractured system. We have state agencies that deal with, you know, this disability and that disability and this disability, and it's very fractured. In other states, they have, you know, some states are like ours. Some states have a county-based system. Some states have regional centers. So it's a little different depending on what state you're in. So you may not be dealing with things exactly the same as we are. So I do want to just, you know, preface that things may not be quite the same as what we are talking about here. So as you are going forward, definitely getting all of your ducks in a row, having all the right paperwork is very important. Saving your paperwork. If you are a younger family, you know, it's a pain having those filing cabinets full of the reports, but how many families have I had who are in appeal now whose adult children are in their 20s or 30s and they are looking at records back to when their children are, you know, from their early years or teenage years, and we're trying to find that early diagnostic report. When did they first get diagnosed with autism? Well, it mentions autism all along, but we cannot find that first report where they go through the criteria that, you know, comes up with that autistic diagnosis, that autism diagnosis. And we have a very difficult time getting services in our state. If you can't come up with that first neuropsych or psychologist or, you know, doctor's report who walks through the steps in the report showing where the diagnosis came from, you don't have that report, you're going to have a really hard time unless you have also an intellectual disability with the testing that goes along with that. So, you know, I hate to say it, I get why there's such a difficulty, because there's very little dollars available compared with the number of people that needs services. But it's kind of up to the families to really be prepared. So that's why we're here. We're here with this podcast. Peter's here to tell you how to be your best advocate. Number one, be prepared, start asking for services and planning early. And that starts way back before you ever need those adult services. Have your records in order. Okay, Peter, let's talk a little bit about good communication before we close out our podcast for today. When you were working for the state agencies, how many people screamed at you, swore at you, freaked out on you? So many. I had a really bad reputation for a little while before I learned how to meditate and relax and, you know, have good communication. I've written many blog posts about this and have written a nice article about 5 steps for key communication, but it took me a long time to get there. So I say this with all humility that it is not easy to be a good advocate and have good communication.
No, it isn't. I have been screamed at in my job as town administrator and as a as an attorney for a state agency many times. I've also been yelled at by a judge, which is never very fun, but you know, it's part of the job. And it's part of the job not to yell back when the judge is yelling at you. I think, it's going to be frustrating and we're all going to have bad days. And so are the people across the desk that you're asking, to help you. But you just remember what works. If someone is asking you to help them, what works best is if they're nice to you or if they're screaming at you and berating you. I bet you're going to say that it's the person that treats me nicely that I'm going to respond better to. And so you can express frustration in a productive way. You can say, hey, this is very frustrating. I'm very frustrated. I hope I'm not coming across this way. And that, you know, the person across the desk is going to understand why you're frustrated and then may, as a result, reach out to you. If you can stay calm, stay courteous, stay professional, that's going to work better for you. And listen when they're telling you something. If they're giving you information, you may be frustrated, you may be angry, but keep your listening skills working. Listen to what they're telling you. And if you don't understand it, ask. I'm sorry. You're going beyond what I can understand. Could you explain it again? Listening and being professional and asking when you don't understand will get you a lot further than ranting and raving. You have to pick and choose the time to be a little bit more assertive. If you're always that assertive, it's going to ring hollow. It's not going to work. If you pick and choose the time that you have, you know, that you're assertive, it'll be more effective. I'm not saying don't ever yell or don't ever raise your voice or don't ever, you know, be stern, but save that for when all else has failed. Mm-hmm. I would just say be calm, be professional and be courteous, and that'll probably be enough.
I like it. It's okay to say, you know, hey, this is not okay, but you can say it in a calm demeanor, and you know, you can tell people that you're unhappy with how things are going. I've sat across an attorney for a school district many times for my own kid, and you know, just said, yeah, this meeting's not going well, and I'm really, really unhappy with what you're offering right now, and I don't appreciate what you are saying about my kid, and I think that we should take a break or we should reschedule for another time so that I can think about what you said. Now, this was after I learned some good techniques You know, because sometimes taking a break can be really good. I know that's hard. Remember at the beginning when Peter said that you shouldn't be rushed? It can feel like things are very urgent a lot of times. And sometimes it can take a really long time to get appointments with people, like 3-4 weeks to get an appointment with people sometimes. And, you know, you can really be feeling like, wow, I've got to get my kid placed. I've only got so much time to get this, you know, XYZ thing done because my kid's turning 22 soon. You know, maybe there's a way to make a backup plan. Maybe there's something you can do to give yourself a little more time so that you don't force yourself, you know, backed into a corner and end up with sort of an irreparable decision. If you don't have money for an advocate, or you don't have an advocate available to you because there isn't one in your area, just having a friend or a neighbor or another parent who's really good at this stuff to bounce ideas off of and practice before you have these difficult conversations can be super helpful, super helpful. You know, sometimes your spouse is not necessarily, or your partner is not necessarily the best person because they're as angry as you are, but just another calm person. Don't pick that person who's going to take your side and say yes to everything that you say. Pick somebody who's going to tell you the truth if you're being a little nutso. Right, Peter?
Yeah. Find somebody who, if you can find somebody who's been through it before and talk to them about their experience, find out what they went through, what worked, what didn't, what to expect. If you know what to expect, you're going to be better prepared. And so talking to somebody, you know, beforehand is going to help you.
Now, Peter and I have one more big case coming up together, and we have been delaying it. And we've been doing that because we've been trying to find the right witness and the right documents. And we finally have all the things that we need. And I don't know, I'm keeping my fingers crossed. I think we're going to win.
We're going to put a strong case forward. There's no question. We've taken this from there's no way we're going to win this, where you and I were just shaking our heads saying, what are we going to do? To, okay, we've got the basis to win this case. So, and it's been a long slug, but we've got good people working on it that are really smart and really good at what they're doing. And then, yeah, I think we'll have a very good case to make.
So, you know, it's another case of where the records are so old that a lot of them have been destroyed and we couldn't get at them, and trying to find the right witnesses has been so difficult. So planning early really helps. But this family is just doing the best that they can, just like all the rest of us. I want to just say thank you so much, Peter, for coming on the podcast today. Do you have any last advice for our families out there?
The last advice is just hang in there. You've got to advocate for yourself. Get as much information from the agencies that you're trying to deal with that you can. And don't be afraid to ask questions. And get the answers and listen to the answers. And if you don't understand the answers, ask again. Just stay the course and keep slugging away. I think it's important to remember that the agency, as I said earlier on, when I worked for an agency, I didn't take the job there so that I could say no to people that needed services. Mm-hmm. I wanted to help them. And that's what the agency personnel really want to do. But you've got to work with them to give them what they need so that they can give you what you need.
Yeah.
And so just patience and persistence is really what you're going to need.
I want to add one thing to that along sure. those lines. When someone does something for you, and maybe even when they're just doing their everyday job, say thank you.
That's huge. I don't think
anybody does. They'll remember you for saying thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Thank you for, you know, acknowledging my child today. Thank you for, you know, for taking my call. I know you're so busy. Thank you for talking with me. Thanks for listening to me today. You brightened my day. Just say something nice. You don't have to give them donuts. You don't have to show up with flowers. Those things are nice, but just thanking them and acknowledging the nice job that they're doing and how hard they work is really critical. You don't have to say it if you don't mean it. Don't say it if you don't mean it, but really just a thank you goes so far.
And right.
It's really meaningful. And I think it can help forge a nice bond with the people that are out there who really are trying to make a difference. Remember the starfish, you know, they're trying too. They really are. So Peter, thanks again. So good to talk to you. Looking forward to catching up with you so that we can make some headway on our cases. And remember everybody, one starfish at a time. If there's anything that you can do to change a life today, please get out there and do it. All right, everybody, have a great day. Thanks.
Hey, everybody, thanks for tuning in. I just wanted to take a second to say how much I appreciate you taking the time to listen to these podcasts. I'm having a blast doing them, and I hope that you're finding the content to be what you were really hoping. If you are, please take a second to leave a rating and a review. It's so helpful in getting this content out to people who really need to hear it. Thank you so much.